Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, joining us is fantastic physicist Jim Al-Khalili. He's Distinguished Chair, Professor of Physics and Professor of Public Engagement in Science at the University of Surrey. He has a new book out called The World According to Physics. Welcome back to the programme, Jim. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Tell me about this book, because on the face of it, it sounds like basic physics.
Well, certainly the level I've aimed at is so that it could be understandable by anyone if they're interested. But it's not basic in the sense of let's start from, you know, school level physics and build our way up, or let's start from Isaac Newton and Galileo and build our way up to Einstein. I'm really trying to give a sort of a status of the field as it is now. What do we know? What have we yet to figure out? So sort of the boundary of the limits of what physics is at in 2020.
And so what sort of areas do you go into in the book?
Well, it's really sort of exploring sort of the fundamental. So it's not the sort of stuff that, you know, you'd learn at school. It's, you know, do we know the nature of space and time themselves? Do we know where the universe came from? You know, we say the universe starts with a big bang. Well, what caused the big bang? Yeah, right. So it's that at that level of sort of deep, profound questions. And also, you know, there are mysteries out there. There's stuff called dark matter, and we don't know what it is. There's dark energy. How can atoms be in two places at once? There are still mysteries that physics hasn't quite resolved. So I try and explore them, giving my view and seeing where we're likely to make progress in the coming years.
Well, you are the first physicist on the program to say they know what happened before the Big Bang. What happened then?
Yeah, well, until recently, it was that sort of question was fobbed off. Oh, well, there's nothing before the Big Bang because, you know, it's like, you know, if you walk to the South Pole and when you get to the South Pole, keep walking south. Right? It's meaningless. Once you get to the South Pole, any direction you walk in is back north again. So it was a bit like that. Nothing before the Big Bang, because there was no time before the Big Bang. Now we're starting to wonder, maybe our local Big Bang that created our universe was something in a pre-existing multiverse with lots of other universities along. So it's almost science fiction.
which version of the multiverse? There's a few different types of ideas of a multiverse, right? Maybe you might explain the different ones and which one you sort of favour at the moment.
Well, it's always difficult for physicists to say, you know, which do I favour or which do I believe in, because that's sort of opinion. That's not science. So, you know, so I have to be sort of rigorous about it. But yes, you're right. There are different. There are two basic types of multiverse theories. One is linked to the world of the very small, quantum physics. So this is the rules that govern how atoms and the particles that make up atoms behave, the rules that allowed us to discover the Higgs boson, for example. But also, you know, quantum mechanics is this wonderfully powerful theory that helped us invent microchips and allows us to actually talk as we are now. You know, the whole of modern electronics relies on quantum mechanics. But at its heart, it's fundamentally weird and counterintuitive. And one of the ways of getting around that is to say, well, if there are parallel universes in a multiverse, then you've come across the famous example of the cat in the box that's, you know, Schrodinger's cat. It could be dead and alive at the same time. This multiverse version sort of explains away some of that mystery. It says, you know, when you open the box, you don't make the cat be dead or alive. There'll be two universes, one in which you open the box to find a live cat, one in which you open it to find a dead cat. So multiverse theory in the quantum context helps explain those mysteries. I'm not a particular fan of that particular version of the multiverse theory, because I think there are other ways of explaining quantum mechanics that are not quite as headache-inducing. But there's the other multiverse idea, which is to do with the very large, not the very small, but the whole universe. And that's the one that leads to this idea of what might there be before the Big Bang. I like it, you know, aesthetically I find it pleasing, but we don't have any evidence for it. But the reason why it's so appealing is because you could ask the question, how come our universe is so perfectly suited for us to have evolved in it? You know, if gravity was ever so slightly weaker stars and galaxies and planets wouldn't have formed, never mind life. If the electric charge on the electron was ever so slightly stronger, then atoms wouldn't have formed in the first place. Again, no life. So it's as though...
Well, I don't know if I can I can subscribe to that, Jim, because surely everything would be thrown out. If slight changes to a particular property, so as you say, you know, the spin of an electron or gravity or the speed of light and so on, everything would be slightly different, but then that could have a different effect on developing life. As we know, it probably wouldn't exist, but unless you can change one property of a scientific world and then just run a loop, which I don't think we can do, like mathematically yet, can we? We don't really know what those changes might do in the wider sense.
Okay, no, you're right, because you know we can say the ingredients or whatever need to be in place and tweaked and fine tuned to allow life on Earth to develop. We needed to have the right gravity, to right distance from the sun, so it's not too hot, not too cold, and so on. Yes, fine. And if it was any different, maybe a different form of life that we can't even imagine would have formed. But I'm picking particular dials to tweak, like the charge on the electron or the force of gravity, because they're so fundamental that if they were any different, never mind other life forms, we just would not have stable matter. So life as we understand it relies on complex structures and information exchange. Doesn't matter whether you got two arms or four arms or whatever, any sort of complex structure that we might imagine called life needs to at least have stuff, atoms that join together. Well, if electrons' charge is slightly different, atoms wouldn't form in the first place. We just would not have matter as it stands. So those universes would be very boring. They you know, a universe like that would sort of maybe explode as a big bang and then just collapse again or expand as a nothingness. You wouldn't see any richness in it at all. So we feel somehow that at a fundamental level, our universe is special. Now, if it was the only universe, the only way really to get your head around that, say, well, you know, maybe there's a divine creator, God, who tweaked the dials and said, you know, let there be light and I want a universe that life can evolve in, fine. But if you want to do without any supernatural explanations, suddenly we are special. And the only way to get around it is to say, well, if there are lots of universes, then we just happen to be the one that's right. You know, it's like the lottery. If there's lots of lottery tickets, the lottery ticket winner would say, oh, how amazing, I won the lottery. Yeah, well, someone had to win it.
Yeah.
Right? So we are in that universe that happened to have the right conditions for us to evolve in.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is why can't we just have that as one universe? Why do we need to create a multiverse? Why can't we just say universe, they say universe is infinite. If the universe is infinite, why can't we just have this really big space where this happens over and over again across many different planets, suns, solar systems, galaxies, as it does, and we just happen to be in that one? Why do we need the multiverse version? Because the multiverse version sounds kooky to me.
It sounds too extravagant, you mean?
it does. It sounds... Well, yeah. I mean, I just don't understand why we just can't say the universe is pretty damn big.
Well, I think that's because we're assuming even if the universe is infinite, it's still part of our space-time. Even if stretching to infinity, the force of gravity on the other side of the universe will be the same as it is here.
No. See, this is why I always break down with it. You can't see the other side of the universe, Jim. If it's infinite, or at least my understanding of infinity, it breaks down if you say the other side of the universe. There is no side of the universe. It keeps going.
Right. Well, let's look at the edge of the visible universe, as far out as we can see, right. 13 billion light years away.
Right.
As far as we can tell, stars and galaxies on the very edge of what we can see have exactly the same properties as ours.
Right.
Now, someone living there presumably will be able to look and see us and say, you know, that Milky Way galaxy has made up of the same ingredients, same atoms, same gravity as us. They could look in another direction beyond what we can see and also say, well, the universe is the same. This is the law of cosmology, that the universe looks the same in all directions, in all places. So even though we can't access anything beyond what we can see, you can take step by step by step and assume there are people or other life forms that are examining the universe around them and seeing that it's all the same. There cannot be a break in the...
No, I mean is I totally get why you're saying and understand why people believe that, but and I love how physicists make that difference between, you know, infinity is the visible universe. It's just it was never my understanding of what the universe is. But what if we are 2 inches away from each other, us and the side of what we call the visible universe? Right. And then what about the end of the universe, the actual end of the universe is miles away. Then only the inch either side of me will only be able to see an inch further. But it could be much, much, much bigger. Why do we not think that?
Absolutely. We do. We have no idea whether our universe stretches on forever or whether it's finite and closed in on itself. It doesn't have an edge in the sense that you can't head off in a rocket and hit a brick wall and say, right, that's it. I've come to the end of the universe. Nothing beyond it. Because... you know, whatever is beyond it should also be space, should also be part of the universe. So it could go on forever, or it could close in on itself. But you can say, well, we can only see so far. That might be a trivially tiny fraction. And of course, anything is a trivial fraction of infinity, because infinity, by definition, goes on forever. But you can carry on saying, if the laws of physics don't change from A to B, and they don't change from B to C and C to D, you can take an infinite number of steps. And that would take you all the way out to infinity, if you like. Okay. And no one point in those steps would you expect to see a sudden change in, say, the force of gravity. But
that seems like sort of confirmation bias that, you know, we expect the world to be what we can see around us.
You have a good point there. That, you know, we can only make judgments and derive our and test our theories based on what we can observe. And extrapolating, we have to have very good reasons to extrapolate some of our views of what we can see beyond what we can see. So that's right. And actually, you know, there are other versions of the multiverse theory that don't talk about, you know, sort of different separate bubbles, right, bubble universes floating separately within some higher dimension, but a single space-time that has regions that are normal space like us, and then there are sort of gaps, you know, where sort of inflation is taking place, and then other regions where they've had their own big bangs. So it's like stitching together all these parallel universes into one infinite fabric. Yeah, it could be. We're speculating on things that it's really...
infinite speculation is what it is.
It is, if good physicists should really, you know, not play that game, we should only be talking about theories that we actually test.
Well, talking about testing, right? I know you sort of break up the book into the three pillars of modern physics: quantum theory, relativity, and thermodynamics. And one of the things I never really understood, that I never got a solid answer on, is I always wanted to ask you: if energy can neither be created or destroyed, right? That's the second rule of thermodynamics.
The first.
So. E equals MC squared is the fundamental idea behind that energy equals mass, and that my mass is equivalent to something that, you know, that has mass, is also energy.
Yes.
So mass and energy, things and energy are essentially the same thing, but in different forms.
Yeah. I mean, one way to think about it is mass is frozen energy.
Right. Okay.
Right. So, you know, you can turn mass into pure energy, and you can freeze energy into lumps of mass, provided you obey certain quantum rules.
Yeah, that idea, the idea that atoms and physical things like this table is also energy, and that the space in between the atoms of this table, theoretically, I should be able to just slice my hand straight and it falls straight through the table because of all the empty space. That always blows my mind when I think about this idea.
The solidity of the table is just the electrons in the table repelling the electrons in your hand.
Yeah, it's mostly just space. I find absolutely that so hard to get my brain around. But so we have energy equaling mass and energy being the same as matter. But this theory this rule, energy can be neither created or destroyed. How does that work then when we talk about antimatter? So you're talking about... matter that when it comes in contact with antimatter, they cancel each other out and they disappear. Now that sounds like energy being destroyed to me.
Antimatter is also like normal matter. It just has, you know, some opposite properties. So the electron has an antimatter particle, which is called a positron, which is exactly stuff. It's made of stuff like the electron is. It has mass.
Yeah.
But it has the opposite properties, like it has positive charge rather than negative charge. You bring an electron and a positron together, and their combined mass converts entirely into pure energy. And so the mass and energy conservation is obeyed. You had mass before, and it's turned into pure energy.
So
energy, you can turn it back into mass again.
So it does actually turn into energy.
It becomes energy. So the electron and the positron disappear entirely, and in their place is exactly the amount of energy needed to satisfy E equals MC squared equation.
A sort of explosion of
exactly. It's, yeah.
So and, what was that look like? I know I'm going down a bit of a rabbit hole here, but this is something that's been on my mind for some time. Have you any idea what that might look like?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, if you come across PET scanners in hospital, that's exactly, people don't realize this, that's exactly what a PET scanner is.
What?
Antimatter. You're creating antimatter. Basically, with a PET scanner, the patient is injected with these radioactive nucleotides, radioactive atoms, materials.
My producer is looking very worried at saying, I did this. It's perfectly fine.
PET scanners are good things, right? They make you better. They can image your brain. Yeah, because they make your brain create antimatter. What happens is these atoms that you're sort of injected with, they spit out antimatter particles, positrons, so the antiparticles of the electrons. Those positrons fly out, they hit an electron, the positron and electron combine together to make energy, and that energy is in the form of light, tiny photons, particles of light. And it's those particles of light that fly out, you need two back to back, and you capture them in detectors in the PET scanner. And so when you capture these light particles, you can basically, the computer traces back where they came from to the point where the matter and antimatter annihilated, and that's what gives you the image.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm very sure. Yeah.
That just sounds, yeah. I often on this program, I have lots of interesting conversations with people, but the conversations I have with physicists, and particularly theoretical physicists, they're the most, it just sounds like magic. It sounds like magic. I had no idea we were creating positrons with.
But the thing is, the people who work on that all the time either don't know or don't care or take it so for granted they don't think it's fascinating. And, you know, people like me who understand how people get enthusiastic about science and trying to communicate it, we think, how come people don't know? You go in a PET scanner, you're being zapped with antimatter. Isn't that cool? And some people think it's cool and some people are terrified.
So do you mind? There have been a few things that have been on my mind. And one of the, because I know you kind of go into this area of the relativity and this speed of light thing being constant. I'm wondering if you might explain how that's possible. Do we know how that's possible?
Well, this is what Einstein's big discovery was in 1905, because physicists thought that, you know, waves need something to travel through. So, you know, sound waves need air, right? In the vacuum of space, no one can hear you scream, as the movie told us. Water waves wouldn't exist without the water. So light waves, it was assumed that light had to be carried by something, and that was called the ether. In the end of the 19th century, scientists looked for the ether and they couldn't find it and they couldn't figure out what was going wrong. And Einstein comes along and says, actually, there's no ether. But that has certain implications. And one of them is that light travels at the same speed regardless of how fast we're moving. So if I shine a torch out into space, I'll see the light moving away from the torch at the speed of light. If you jump in a rocket and fly at 99% the speed of light, chasing the torchlight, you will still see it zooming past you at the same speed that I see it. You'd think it's like, you know, slow cars and fast cars on a motorway. You'd see the light crawling past you because you're almost going at its speed.
Yeah.
But no, everyone sees light traveling at the same speed. And it's one of those very counterintuitive ideas, but turns out that is exactly how our universe works. Light is somehow woven into the fabric of space and time. And that's what leads to things like time slowing down and space getting squashed. And onto things like black holes and so on. So it's a very simple idea. Light travels at the same speed for everyone, and you test it and turns out, yep, that's exactly right. And we know it's correct. It's not a theory, it's a proved idea. Absolutely. And it's been proven again and again and again, and we understand why it is. But it tells us that light travels at this very special speed. It's not light that's special, it's the speed itself. This is the maximum speed possible in our universe. It's nothing is allowed to go faster because it's not allowed by the way space and time are created. And so it's this maximum speed possible. Light happens to be able to travel at this maximum speed, and that gives light some of its weird properties.
Well, the book is filled, not necessarily with that story, but lots of other stories about the nature of our universe, from the extreme cosmic to the quantum. It's called The World According to Physics. Jim Al-Khalili, thanks very much.
My pleasure.